For the week of October 9th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 122, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the Two Boots Pizzeria in Brooklyn, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, what are you doing in a pizzeria?
Celebrating the birthday of my friend Nanny Brooklyn, a bleacher creature, a person I sit next to at Yankee Stadium and have for many years. October 13th is her birthday. Normally, we're celebrating postseason baseball and watching a game on TV or at the stadium live. Unfortunately, this year, the Yankees got kicked out in the first round, so her birthday party is more like a wake.
Yes, our condolences, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm a Yankee fan myself and was a little disappointed to see them get thrown out by the Detroit Tigers. Now, before we get started this week into the news, because there is a lot of news to talk about, I should say and mention that we are now available not only on iTunes and the Zune Marketplace, but also on Stitcher. If you go to Stitcher.com, you can find us in their directory, and you can also download their mobile app and listen to us on the go.
What's Stitcher?
It's a mobile application that allows you to listen to radio shows and podcasts and audio content on the go.
What's their advantage over what's out there now? What's their angle?
You can stream the content and you don't have to download it necessarily.
I see. So if as long as you have an internet connection.
Internet or 3G, yes.
Yeah.
And I should also mention, of course, you can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com or call us 888-567-7263. But we should probably move right along into the news for today's show, because we can't help but talk about the passing of Apple co-founder and chairman Steve Jobs this past Wednesday, one day after his company announced their latest iPhone. I know that a lot has already been said on the subject. In fact, I think we're reaching the point now of media saturation on the story, but
that won't stop us.
Yeah, that will not stop us. Michael and I will tell you about Jobs' history with Pixar, which really hasn't been discussed too much or in as much detail over the past week. We'll also try to decipher when a movie becomes profitable. I think I know the answer to that. Never. Over in television news, networks have started to axe some of the series that haven't performed well this season, and we'll tell you which ones didn't make the cut. A show that won't be canceled is The Simpsons. That's because the cast voices behind the popular animated series have agreed to lower their per-episode salary from ungodly wealthy to stinking rich. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop and end with some correspondence from listeners. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right. Our weekend figures from the box office worldwide are a little sketchy this year. We didn't get a full breakdown from the studios via Hollywood Reporter or Variety. We had to piece together the information more so today than elsewhere. We depend on them to sort of release that international box office so we can add all the figures together. And they didn't really do that this week, but we did pull some numbers from individual movies. So the number one movie around the world is Hugh Jackman's Real Steel, which grossed $49.4 million worldwide. It was the number one film in North America and also the number one film around the world. About 10% of that came from IMAX screenings around the world. But it's a solid start for the Hugh Jackman film, which is a very important one for the studio. They've had a bad year at DreamWorks, and they could use a hit. It's not a massive out-of-the-box hit, at least not in the U.S. We'll have to see how it holds up, but it's a good start. At number two in the box office worldwide is Johnny English Reborn. That's the James Bond spoof starring Rowan Atkinson that finally opened in the U.K., where it had its biggest debut ever for a Rowan Atkinson starrer. It grossed $21.3 million worldwide, and it opens here in North America in a week or two. It's at $61 million and counting. At number three, we believe, is The Ides of March, the George Clooney film, which grossed $10.4 million in North America only. At number four is Dolphin Tale, which is holding quite well. That grossed $9.2 million. It's at just under $50 million worldwide. Basically, it's opened only in the U.S. At number five is Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which grossed another $7.8 million worldwide. It's at $420 million and counting. At number six is Moneyball, which grossed $7.5 million, basically in North America only. That's also just under $50 million. And at number seven is The Smurfs, which grossed another $7.3 million overseas. It was bumped out of the number one slot after 8 weeks by the Hugh Jackman film Real Steel. It has grossed $532 million worldwide and counting. So that's a mix of U.S. and overseas numbers. Also in the U.S. Only, we have 50-50, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt comedy about cancer, which grossed $5.5 million. It's at $17 million and counting, which is pretty good for a movie that only costs $8 million to make. At number six is Courageous, which grossed $4.6 million. At number seven in North America is The Lion King, which grossed another $4.5 million. It's at $85 million and counting in North America. At number eight is Dreamhouse, which grossed another $4.5 million. It's a horror film which has collapsed pretty quickly. It dropped by about 45%. It's at $14 million and counting for a movie that cost $50 million to make. 9, 10, 11, 12 are just a lot of holdovers like What's Your Number, the Sarah Jessica Parker comedy, which is falling fast, Abduction, Contagion.
Wait, I don't think that's the Sarah Jessica Parker comedy. I thought, I don't know.
Oh, that's out of the top 10 completely, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
No, What's Your Number is the Anna Faris comedy, which grossed, right?
Yeah, $3 million, and it's at $10 million total.
It's at $10 million total. It only cost $20 million to make. So, but it has fallen 43% in its second weekend. So not great. Nobody will lose their shirt, but not a breakout numbers for that. And then there's Abduction, the Taylor Lautner film, Contagion, which is at $68 million total, Killer Elite, and The Help and Drive, which are still holding on in the top 15. The Help grossed another $2 million, and Drive, starring Ryan Gosling, grossed another $1.8 million, and it's at $30 million and counting.
Yeah, well, thanks to The Ides of March and Moneyball and Courageous, Sony has now passed $1 billion for 2011, and they join, I guess, four other studios that have done that already.
Three.
Well, yes, I'm sorry, you're right. Three, Paramount, Warner Brothers, and Disney. So domestically here in North America, you've got four studios having earned $1 billion, which makes sense if you have a $10 billion industry and six studios. A few of them have to make $1 billion.
I mean, right, and one way they're doing that is by re-releasing movies in 3D.
Disney, of course. They are just, boy, they take the cake for creating their own meme. But they are now going to release four different animated classics in 3D, starting with Beauty and the Beast in January of 2012, then jumping to September 2012 with Finding Nemo in 3D, then back to January 2013, Monsters, Inc. 3D, and then going all the way back to 1989 when they released The Little Mermaid, they're going to release in September 2013 The Little Mermaid in 3D.
So basically you're looking at two movies a year, one in January, one in September for the next 2 years that they plan to release, because The Lion King made, you know, it's made $100 million worldwide and counting. This was always the Disney model throughout the 60s and 70s, 50s, 60s. And, I mean, I don't even remember when they started it, but it was their model for decades. That's where they made a lot of their money, re-releasing their classic films every 7 years. And now they're getting a chance to do it again thanks to 3D.
Yeah, you kind of had to believe this was going to happen. I mean, with The Lion King making an extra, you know, $100 million, give me a break. Well,
absolutely. But what do you think about this analyst?
Okay, so I guess what you're talking about is what Eric Handler of MKM Partners said. He said, we view the decision and the likelihood of more major blockbuster titles being reformatted for a 3D re-release as an attractive opportunity for the Hollywood studios and movie theater operators such as Cinemark and Regal. And he went on to talk about how they have having to select classic films, not just every film, to reformat as 3D, and it could add $200 million to $300 million in domestic box office annually. He's probably right about that.
Oh, actually, I think he's probably wrong.
Really? You don't think that one or two well-placed movies every year could add an additional $100, $150, $200 million to the box office?
No, I think there's very few films. I think you'll see that for the next two or three or four years, and then the glow will fall off of it. Remember they released Toy Story and Toy Story 2 in 3D. How did that go? Not so well. I think there's a very limited appetite for that. Yes, Titanic and Star Wars. And he mentions, you know, E.T. E.T. in 3D?
I'm not interested. Yeah.
The Lord of the Rings trilogy? I don't think so. You know, maybe. I don't even know if Peter Jackson would do it. But I just think it's a fad and it's going to fade. You know, I'm not interested in seeing any of those movies.
But do you think he's talking past the next 4 or 5 years? I don't think he was. I think he was really just saying, you know, over the next 5 years, it could add $200 million to $300 million in domestic box office. Beyond that, we can't tell.
Well, if he's predicting the fact that it's already been committed and happening, meaning we have Titanic and Star Wars lined up to go and now four Disney films, well, all right, he's pointing to the obvious. I don't think most of those Disney movies will be nearly the hit that The Lion King was.
But don't you think that's what analysts do? I want their jobs. They point out the obvious and then say, pay me.
Okay. Well, there now. Sorry about that, Mr. Handler, but I don't know. I don't think even those other – I mean, I don't know if those other movies will do as well for Disney. I think it's You know, I mean, as long as they keep charging extra money. I mean, I was surprised by Lion King. I was wrong. It did much better than I expected. I don't know if it's going to continue.
Well, you know, part of releasing Monsters, Inc. in 3D is the fact that they have a sequel, a Monsters, Inc. sequel, coming out. I think it's called Monsters University.
That's right. It's a prequel, actually, I believe.
Yes.
Which I didn't know that before, but that seems to be the case. And that's true. That's a smart setup. But, you know, there was Toy Story 3D double feature. That grossed $30 million in the U.S. when they released Toy Story 1 and 2. That's nothing to sneeze at. I don't know how much it costs to reformat it and market it. It costs like $10 to $15 million, right, to do both of those movies, probably?
Yeah, probably about $10 million per film, yes.
Per film, okay. So that's $10 million. That's $20 million plus marketing. Did they even break even there?
It grossed
$35 million worldwide. And I think that was a pretty good take. I don't know how much more they would expect to do, but that's pretty darn good, an extra $35 million. I think The Lion King is an outlier. So those other movies, to expect them to make $100 million, no, I don't, you know, I don't think so. I think, you know, low $30, $40 million would be a great return for The Little Mermaid in 2012.
That's probably true. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean,
so, you know, spend $10 million to make $20 million.
But you know what? Here's the thing. All of these movies are already profitable.
That's true. But to think that they're going to make an extra $100 million is what I take issue with. When is a movie profitable?
I have absolutely no idea. But, I, you know, I'm going to stick with never.
Well, that's a great answer. But we did get an email from a reader weeks ago. We had run through some movies and said, oh, this is profitable. That's not profitable. This is profitable. That's not profitable. And they said to me, well, how do you know when a movie is profitable? You're referring to the fact that when you're talking about accounting, movies are never profitable. Even the biggest hits on the books tend not to be profitable because the studio keeps charging themselves money. They want to keep net profits down to a minimum or zero. So on the accounting books, movies are rarely profitable. But in the parlance of Hollywood, when we look at a movie's release and say, is this movie a hit? Did this movie make money? Did that movie make money? We use all sorts of factors and sort of insider knowledge to determine our rough estimate of whether a movie seems to be profitable. Here at Showbiz Sandbox, we often blithely dismiss one movie as being a box office loser and another as a hit, even though they might seem similar in budgets and box office. Why is The Lone Ranger a good bet to gross $700 million, and how could that mean that Disney still wouldn't make money on it? The truth is that every film is literally its own business and often incorporated for tax purposes in that very way. Every film is its own unique case study. So when we consider a film a hit or a flop, we're making numerous judgments about the movie based on the talent involved and how much money they would get, the budget, the studio that released it, how it was released, what time of year, and a lot of other details like merchandising that can be pretty fuzzy. It's always a judgment call because obviously we don't have access to the books. But to try and explain what sort of judgments we're making, we've decided to look at several different movies and explain why we consider them a hit or a miss.
All right, so now the first one you'd like to look at is The Hangover 2.
That's right, The Hangover 2. It's a sequel to a hit comedy.
Right.
It stars actors who are not massive stars, who can't demand big paydays, like people like Bradley Cooper, Zach Galifianakis, and director Todd Phillips, who made Old School and Road Trip and Starsky and Hutch. So he was a name, but not a huge name when they made the original. It is a franchise in a sense. It cost $80 million to make, which was a big jump on the original. It's a pure movie. You're not going to sell a lot of posters or video games or beer tie-ins to this one. It's just a movie. And it probably costs maybe $80 million to market worldwide, if not more.
So it's 100. Figure even if it cost $160 million to market worldwide.
That would be $240 million.
And it made $576 million at the worldwide box office. So
right. Half of that comes back to the studio, roughly.
Right.
Right. That's a sort of a rule of thumb. So if it's 570, that means $280 million came back to the studio. So then you're talking about barely $20 million in profit.
On your theatrical run, you still have home video, ancillary rights, television, so you're profitable.
And $160 million, probably high.
Yes, correct.
Yes. But it's funny. You say it costs $80 million to make, and it grossed $580 million practically, and yet their profits were minimal. You know, at the theatrical boxes. So we're down to reduce to saying, oh, well, then maybe they made $20, $30, $40 million. That seems pretty shocking, doesn't it?
Well, that's kind of what these studios are taking risks on now. They're effectively saying, look, you know, the theatrical run is just a big giant commercial for the home video release and for television and for pay cable.
That used to be the case. But nowadays with DVD slowing down, don't they need to make their money on theatrical? And it's not a high budget movie. It only costs $80 million to make. That's a pretty low risk. It's a sequel to a very successful movie. It only cost $80 million to make. It's hard to believe that they couldn't expect a bigger upside for it when it worked so well.
Yes, you're absolutely right. They are really having to rethink where they make their money. Studios used to just kind of say break even or lose a little bit of money on the theatrical, make all our money on DVD, pay cable, and all the ancillary markets. Now they're saying, well, it would kind of be nice if we make some money on theatrical, since let's face it, we're not going to make as much in those ancillary areas.
Now, here's a movie that's very hard to judge. It's called The Smurfs.
It's because they're so tiny. It's really hard to see them. That's why.
It stars Neil Patrick Harris and a lot of animated voices. It cost $110 million to make, even though it's a combination of live action and animation. That can be pretty pricey. They probably spent at least $100 million marketing around the world. It was a spring release here in the U.S., correct?
No, was it was kind of a summer release. Yeah.
It was a summer release and here and around the globe. And it's obviously been number one overseas for like 2 months in a row now.
That's right.
So it was a very big success overseas. It has grossed $532 million worldwide and counting worldwide to date on a budget of $110 million. But there are some questions for us. You know, like Neil Patrick Harris, would he get a cut of the movie? I don't think so. He'd probably get a couple million to make the movie, maybe $2 million, $3 million. Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah, well, you'd have to know whether he had any back-end participation and whether
he couldn't demand that.
Well, you never know.
He's not that big a star yet. He's never opened a movie.
Well, he has now.
No, I don't know if he has. It's really more the Smurfs than him.
Okay.
He's along for the ride. I love Neil Patrick Harris. He's an actor on a hit TV show, How I Met Your Mother. He's been in a number of movies like Harold and Kumar and done well. He's a terrific actor. I've seen him on Broadway. But he's not a star in the sense that he's opened a movie, so therefore he couldn't demand a piece of the back end on the Smurfs, I don't think.
Maybe not.
Right. But the question is licensing rights and merchandising. You know, this obviously is a big product, the Smurfs. It's a huge franchise property. They sell lots of toys with it. But the studio probably couldn't expect a lot of that to come back to them. In fact, the people who own the rights to the Smurfs are probably getting a piece of the film.
That's right. Of course. Yeah, just like Hasbro gets a piece of Transformers and Marvel gets a piece of Spider-Man. Well, they even finance Spider-Man, so that's a bad example. But
right. So the Smurfs are at McDonald's. So they're selling the toys. They're selling the Happy Meals. DVDs are obviously very strong for family films.
That's right. This will be a big DVD.
That's right. And it's revitalizing a franchise, which had been pretty morbid. There hadn't been Smurfs TV shows in a while. The property was still selling, but it had been a long time since they had a lot of heat. And so this is good news for everybody. A solid hit movie means more interest for comic books, video games, pajamas, cereal, you name it. But you've got the original Belgian creators. You've got Hanna-Barbera, who created the TV show. You've got the Smurfs in theme parks coming up. Nobody has the rights to them right now, but surely somebody wants that. So who gets what cut? Who gets to exploit the most? It's hard to tell.
Well,
so,
you know, actually, it's not going to be that hard to tell after they go to court.
Well, is there anybody going to court?
No, I just am assuming is what will happen down the line.
So there are a lot of fingers in the pie on the Smurfs. We've been saying for a while, hey, it looks like a no-brainer for a sequel. It cost $110 million to make. It's at $500 million and counting worldwide. That's a success. Usually the rule of thumb is like, if you triple your budget, you're going to be all right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of a very rough rule of thumb. It doesn't mean you're raking in the dough. But again, it cost $110 million to make. It grossed $500 million. And we're wondering how much, if anything, the studio has made on it. It's sort of a weird world. But
Now, you have three other films to discuss. Which one do you want to start with? Green Lantern?
Let's do Bad Teacher, because that seems more germane. Bad Teacher is very dissimilar from these other movies. It costs $19 million to make.
So basically somebody made it with the money they had in their pocket.
Yeah, I wish I had. You know, this was a spring release, right?
No, it was a summer release.
Oh my God, my mind is...
Time is flying, my friend.
Yeah. They probably spent good money to market it worldwide, but it's not a huge movie. So it wouldn't have cost as much as something like The Smurfs or, right. So would it be $80 million worldwide to market it?
I highly doubt that. For a film that costs $20 million, you're going to spend four times the amount? No, I don't think so.
But doesn't that happen sometimes when you think you have a valuable property? Like you make it for pennies even because you know you're going to be having to pay $60, $70 million to market it. I mean, it's just how can you do it? TV ads, trailers. So this is being released by Sony. So it's not like it's an indie film, but they made it at indie prices for $19 million, which probably means that the star Cameron Diaz, well, she probably got a big paycheck because she's one of the biggest female stars in the world, or she just agreed to get a big piece of the back end.
Or both.
Is that possible?
Yes.
I mean, it cost $19 million to make. She couldn't have gotten her fee.
No, not at all. I mean, her fee is probably in the millions, so.
Oh, no, it's definitely in the millions, but she's gotten $10 million at times for a movie, you know, like Charlie's Angels and things like that. Obviously, she didn't take her fee, so that means she gets a piece of the back end, right?
Yeah, I would imagine so, yes. You wouldn't do a film like this for $19 million, unless it was some, like, you know, Brokeback Mountain kind of independent film that you never really thought had a chance of making any money to begin with.
That created problems because that movie did make money and the people involved creatively felt gypped because they were all asked to take a, you know, cut to make it happen.
Now but you're talking about Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, they didn't share in the profits when the studio said, oh, no, it's not profitable. And they're like, wait a second. You told us to make it for love. And if it turned into a hit, we'd make money. And when it turned into a hit, you screwed us over. The director of Bad Teacher is Jake Kasdan, who made Zero Effect, Orange County, and Walk Hard. So he was looking for a hit, so he didn't get a lot of money.
No.
The co-stars are Justin Timberlake and Jason Segel, both guys glad to be in the movie. So really, it's Cameron Diaz we're talking about as far as getting a piece of the pie. Sony bought the script and made the film. It was a pure studio play with two writers, producers on The Office looking to break into film and Kasdan needing a hit. So everybody involved was sort of in a weak position except for Cameron Diaz and what she might have set aside for the back end. It costs $19 million to make. It grossed $213 million worldwide. It's clearly profitable.
Yeah, because it'll do, you know, it's got HBO and Showtime and DVD. It's profitable.
The question is, did she get 3 points, 5 points?
I mean, you'll never know.
We'll never know. But what would be reasonable? What would you even think might be possible for someone like
3% would be a huge deal.
That would be a huge deal?
I think so, yeah.
But that would only mean she would get $6 million. That's well below her normal quote, I think.
Yeah, but that's welcome to the new Hollywood.
That's possible. And it gave her, you know, frankly, her first big hit in a while that she can really take credit for. I think it really brought her back in a sense. So I think it was a good bet, even if she only, and I'm putting that in quotes, made $6 million. But so even here, you can see how complicated it gets. You got to figure out who's the star involved, what's the position of the actors and the talent involved. Did the studio make it themselves or did they pick it up from a third party? And that brings us to Apocalypto, a Mel Gibson film from 2006. I got into a big argument with a friend about whether this was profitable or not. And he convinced me that I was wrong. And in fact, it probably made very little or no money for a couple of reasons. Number one, it cost $40 million to make. And in fact, Mel Gibson funded it out of his own money. His film company, Icon Productions, made the movie.
Now, remember, this was a film in a foreign language.
This was, it was in an obscure language. It wasn't even like it was in French.
Yeah.
It was an obscure language that almost nobody spoke. So you're talking about a subtitled film.
For everybody on the planet.
For everybody on the planet. It cost $40 million to make and grossed $143 million. Well, that means it grossed four times the budget, to which I would say, oh, wow, okay, that must be profitable.
Yes, but then you have P&A.
Well, you have the P&A, and it was a December release. I don't remember having a big P&A budget, but other people said, no, that was a big release. They pushed it and marketed it.
They did.
So that could be anything like $60 million. You know, there wasn't a big campaign for it. It was just trailer, Mel Gibson, go see his newest movie from
the
guy.
I would say, you know, you put down $20 million here. I wouldn't say it's probably about right. Between $20 and $30 million. It's probably about right.
For a holiday release?
Yes.
Worldwide?
Worldwide, that would be pushing it maybe.
But then you have to remember that he's not releasing the film. If the studio had made the movie, then they get to charge themselves a cost and they can make money, even though they charge themselves money for releasing it. But because Mel Gibson's company had to get someone else to release it, they had to, you know, reach out to a distributor and get them to release the film. And that meant the distributors took like a piece of the back end as well, right?
15%. You're between like 7 and 15%, with 15 being the high end.
Right. So if it's 10%, that would mean they would get about $14 million.
Correct. Yes. Plus recoup any expenses.
Plus half the worldwide gross goes to the theatrical distributed to the exhibitors. That means out of $140 million, $70 million stays with the theater owners, which means you're talking about $70 million in profits. The budget was $40 million. The P&A was $20 or $30 million. The studio gets
between, depending on whether they get, you know, 15% of the gross or 15% of the net gross, you know, it depends.
Right. But well, I mean, nobody would get a piece of the net gross because there'd be no money for him.
No, well, the net gross is after the exhibitors pay you. So it's not.
Well, it'd be 15% of $70 million.
Correct. Yes.
Right. So it could be $7 million fee for distributing the movie. That seems awfully low.
From a film like that where you didn't really put that much into it, why not?
But so if you're talking $40 million budget, $7 million to the studio, $20 million to the
I mean, at this point you realize we've completely confused our audience.
Well, I said you paid $40 million to make the movie, you and $10 million to release it, and $20 million to
the bottom line is it lost
that's
money.
$70 million. You brought in $70 million. So at best, it's a wash.
Right, which is, you know, for Mel Gibson and one of his vanity projects, not necessarily a bad thing.
I don't know if it's fair to call them vanity projects just because he funds them himself. I mean, that used to be a classic Hollywood move. You know, producer David O. Selznick would fund his own movies. They weren't vanity projects. They were major releases.
Yeah, producer David O. Selznick worked in a completely different time than Mel Gibson.
I'm saying, but there's a long tradition of people funding their own movies just because it's a subtitled film. You know, in a second language that got good reviews and made its money back. You know, it's not exactly to me an indulgent take home thing.
I mean, a lot of people thought he had he went off the reservation on that particular film.
Well, I thought it was his best directed movie.
Okay.
Personally, it got good reviews, pretty good reviews. I know there are some people who really like it in Hollywood, but he didn't lose his shirt, at least. We know that. So again, you know, you say a movie costs $40 million to make and it grossed $160 million worldwide if you include DVD. And you say, well, gee, it quadrupled its budget. That sounds like a hit. But he didn't release it himself. But they had to pay money for P&A. But this, that, and the other thing. And all those fees add up. It's very hard to make a movie profitable. So there's some things you got to remember. Studios typically get about half of a movie's box office gross back to them. The other half goes to the exhibitor. So if a movie grosses $400 million, the studio actually receives only $200 million. The bigger the stars, the more likely they are to get a cut of the profits. So when you look at Pirates of the Caribbean and Johnny Depp, just remember Johnny Depp, Jerry Bruckheimer, and the director all get a big chunk of that movie. Prints and advertising are expensive. The bigger the release date, like July 4th or Thanksgiving or Christmas, the more it costs to release. Spring and early fall are not so expensive. And don't forget the DVDs and video on demand and cable and merchandising and theme park rides and so on. That's still a big source of revenue for the studio, and it's all sort of gravy once they've paid to get the movie out into theaters. And reviews matter. A borderline movie like X-Men First Class glows a lot more brightly for everyone involved because it's actually a good movie and it got good reviews. So it may not have been a massive profitable film, but it revitalized the franchise. People feel good being associated with it, and that makes them more likely to make a sequel. And you got to double your budget to even think about breaking even, perhaps even triple your budget. That's just a standard rule of thumb. If you don't do that, there's no chance you're going to make money.
So you see, it's all really easy, this movie making business.
That's right. So every time we talk about a movie and say, oh, it's profitable, it's not profitable, we are juggling a whole lot of different factors in our heads in the same way that all the competitors are doing when they look at a studio's movies and figuring out whether it's a hit or not. Obviously, only the people who have access to the books actually know what deals are made, but you can make a pretty good guess.
Nobody has access to the books.
Not even the studio.
Well, that kind of concludes our movie news for the week and moves us right along into the news about Steve Jobs' death and his passing. And this is something Michael and I struggled with, whether we should talk about it at all or how we should cover this, because let's face it, it's been beaten to death by the media over the past 5 days.
So we're going to sort of focus in on Pixar.
Yes.
That's where we think we have something interesting to say.
I mean, certainly we all know that, you know, Steve Jobs revolutionized the music industry and, you know, helped create the single all over again, and his iPod, you know, and digital music and iTunes. Everybody knows that story.
And how he, you know, obviously the iPad has created a whole new industry, the smartphone. You know, he's been impactful in a lot of different ways. But people haven't talked a lot about his role with Pixar. It gets mentioned in every story, certainly. But I think one fact that people don't realize is that when did Steve Jobs first become a billionaire? When did he really hit his payday? It was not through Apple. It was through Pixar.
That's right. That's right. And it was the day that Pixar went public, shortly after Toy Story was released in 1995. But it was a long road for him to get to that point.
So now, what was his role in Pixar? Did he just write checks, or did he have some creative impact there?
Both, really. But one prefaced the other. And what I mean by that is, you know, everybody knows Steve Jobs was the co-founder of Apple, and he helped launch the Macintosh. But in 1985, he was working for Apple, brought John Sculley in, this CEO from Pepsi that he had helped recruit, and he effectively got kicked out of the company because, as Jeff Raskin, who was the originator of the Macintosh project, put it, you know, he was just a difficult person to work with. And he gave, you know, this whole long list of reasons, including that, you know, Jobs does not give credit where due, and that he often reacts ad hominem, and he is often irresponsible and inconsiderate. And I know that, you know, these are not the stories you hear now that he has passed away, but that Jobs was, you know, he was kind of a prickly pear, to say the least. When he was working on the Macintosh project, he would park his Mercedes in the handicap spot because it was in the front of the building, and he was assured nobody would actually go out and key his car.
Did people actually ever key his car?
No, because he parked in the.
That was how much he was disliked at the time.
Yes, correct. And so,
and of course, you have to note that over the years he mellowed a bit and became a little easier to work with. Not that he wasn't ever always pushing, aggressive, but you know, that was 25, 26 years ago,
and he was in his 20s.
When he came back to Apple, he evolved as a leader to a degree.
Yes. Well, he tried this whole boardroom coup when Sculley came in and was going to push him aside, and he was going to do this whole thing where he took over the company and took it back from Sculley. It failed, and he was not necessarily fired, but he was given a job that he would ultimately just want to resign from. And that's exactly what happened. And he was kind of moping around, and somebody, one of his friends from Apple, who he had hired from at Apple, introduced him to Ed Catmull and a team up at Lucasfilm that was really the computer division and the computer graphics division and imaging division at Lucasfilm. It was started in 1979, and they were floundering a bit, and Lucasfilm was looking to get rid of them.
Why?
Because they just weren't very profitable, and Lucas realized, wow, this is great. These guys really know what they're doing. These guys are the experts at computer imaging and computer graphics. Now, if we only had computers that could actually do what they would like. Unfortunately, that's 10 to 15 years away. And by the way, Lucas was not wrong about that. So he was looking for people to buy Pixar. And Catmull and his team, by the way, Catmull is still associated with Pixar. They went to Jobs' house in 1985, I think it was the fall of 1985, and they met with Jobs in his 17,000 square foot house, which had nothing in it other than a BMW motorcycle parked inside and a grand piano. So that, you know, that all that kind of stereotype of Steve Jobs and being a minimalist, you know, a 17,000 square foot house, nothing in it. But they said, look, you know, they left that meeting and said, you know what? He's really bitter over this whole Apple thing, and he's really gunning for Sculley. We don't want to have anything to do with him right now. We know he can be a bit of a tyrant. But after 10 months of going back and forth with different suitors, Lucasfilm still didn't have a buyer for Pixar, and Jobs came back to them and offered what he initially offered, which was $5 million. And that was something, you know, Lucasfilm wanted like $15 million. And so Lucas agreed to sell the company to him and the employees, the Lucasfilm computer graphics division employees. So they were kind of co-owners. Pixar was created, you know, in 1986 in January, with both the division employees and Steve Jobs owning them.
He bought Pixar for the computers. He didn't buy it because he thought he was going to be making animated films.
Well, no, that's a great point, actually, because you're absolutely right. I mean, his whole interest in this was he looked at these people who knew computer graphics so well and said, you know what? They've created this computer, a computer called, by the way, Pixar, and we can sell those computers. We could market those computers. But, you know, Steve Jobs' vision was always, you know, on a mass market scale. And these computers were supercomputers. These were high-end servers. And they could not really mass market these computers. And at the time, Pixar had this really small group of people. It was John Lasseter, this guy John Lasseter, and these part-time graphics scientists who kind of lent their efforts every once in a while to whatever Lasseter was working on. You know, in Jobs' eyes, that was never meant to make any money, this whole animation thing.
Well, I mean, the only reason they even made an animated short was to sort of demonstrate what the power of the computers was.
You're absolutely right, Michael. It wasn't, frankly, a big deal for Jobs. And, you know, the animators hated Jobs. They did not like working with Jobs. They were completely oil and water. And the reality was that this Pixar image computer was way ahead of its time. It was difficult to attract customers. And as far as Jobs was concerned, that's all he wanted them for was their technology.
Right. But on the side, they were getting some business. They almost got to do the antagonist in Terminator 2, the Liquid Man, but they did get to
they did the Abyss.
They did the Abyss, the silvery underwater creature in the Abyss.
Well, if they didn't do it, I think that may have been ILM. But the reality is they created this software that ran on their Pixar computers called RenderMan. And that became the kind of de facto software, the industry standard for how all of that CGI was done. If you were doing that type of CGI, you were using the software RenderMan. And that came from Pixar.
But that still didn't make them profitable.
No, they were doing these little commercials. Meanwhile, you know, you have Jobs writing check after check after check and going to these weekly meetings and, you know, having an office at Pixar, which, by the way, little aside, the laptop in that office, he hated Apple so much, the laptop in his Pixar office ran Windows.
Where are you getting all this information from?
Well, there is a book called The Pixar Touch, and it was written by David A. Price. That is one place, and there are a number of books on Pixar that were written, and it's well documented what wound up happening over the years from 1986 when he purchased it to 1995 when Disney released Toy Story for Pixar. Because really, what wound up happening, long story short, if that's possible at this point, Disney bought some of these Pixar computers. They then turned to Pixar and said, hey, wait a second, you know, you guys are really good at this whole animation thing. Do you think you can make a whole feature? But Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was the chairman of Disney at the time, at least the film division, and of course was working on Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and all of these feature films, he did not trust Steve Jobs, because Steve Jobs, as he put more and more money in, as Ed Catmull said, we started out as a hardware company and frankly should have failed. But Steve, who'd been kicked out of Apple, could not sustain the embarrassment. Whenever we got into trouble, Steve would write another check and get more equity. Over the next few years, he bought the entire company. Well, that's true and not true. What he wound up doing was he owned enough of the company to mandate that all of the stock that the company owned be sold to a new company. Let's call it New Pixar. Well, guess who owned New Pixar outright, 100% of it? He did.
Steve Jobs.
Right. And he paid the employees at Pixar 10 cents, which was their option price on the stock. And of course, they were all hoping it would be worth millions of dollars. It caused such ill will and a huge rift within Pixar. People hated him there. And Katzenberg didn't trust him because of that. But he said, all right, we'll cut this deal. 3-picture deal. We'll start with this little film that you call Toy Story. But here's the deal. I will get the rights to come in and take over the project at any time, put my own writers on, put my own animators on, whatever I want, because I don't trust you Pixar guys. Disney originally said, we'll pay the $17.5 million for it. Costs increased to about $21.1 million. And then by 1994, the cost was, you know, going north of $27 million. At this point, starting in like 1991, Jobs had tried to sell Pixar a couple of times to different entities, including Microsoft. And he was very close to selling them to Microsoft. But then in 1994, he began to realize, you know what? There's something going on here over at Pixar, and I'm going to pull out of this deal. And he pulled out at the very last minute. At this point, it's 1994. He's poured about $50 million into the company. And, you know, he still has yet to see a profit. He still has yet to see any money come back. The business is losing money hand over fist. And they're making this movie Toy Story. In December of that year, one of the Pixar executives went down to Disney to meet with their consumer products division, who told the Pixar executive, we don't really see any licensing potential in Toy Story, which is very ironic, I think. Mm-hmm. So then in January 1995, Jobs flies to New York with Lasseter and Catmull and a few others, and he sits through a screening of Toy Story. Now, this is almost a year before the movie comes out. And this is a turning point.
Is this a public screening or a...
It's probably
a test screening?
A test screening, yes. It's a test screening. And this little moment is a huge turning point because Jobs ate up the audience's positive reaction. He really loved the fact that the audience responded so well, because that was what Jobs was about, was that emotional connection to some type of product. In this case, it just happened to be a film. But it's the same thing when it's an iPhone or an iPod. So he immediately stepped in as CEO and stopped being just the managing, you know, check writer and negotiator, because he negotiated the original deal with Jeffrey Katzenberg was him. He negotiated that. He negotiated a three-picture deal.
Well, it was his company.
Right. And he then, at that point, in January of 95 and February of 95, he started to make plans to take the company public by the end of the year. As we already said, that's what made him $1 billion when that company went public. Bug's Life, Toy Story 2 were hits, and Jobs had to sit down with Disney again to negotiate a distribution contract, and Hollywood was stunned what he walked away with. He was able to get amazing terms. But by 2004, Steve Jobs had, of course, returned to Apple.
Well, but let's put it in context. A Toy Story came out in November of 1995.
Correct.
In 1996, he was back in charge at Apple.
Right. And the whole time that this whole Pixar thing is going on, know that he's also over at Next Computer, which was the computer company that A, was his favorite project. So let's get that out of the way. And B, was the company he founded after Apple that was going to, usurp
Apple.
Wipe
the floor with them. Yeah.
Right. Unfortunately, it was doing very poorly, much like Pixar. He was kind of the laughingstock of Silicon Valley, because both of these companies were huge debacles. Nobody thought that Toy Story was going to do well, at least in Silicon Valley. But in the end, it did. And Steve Jobs went from thinking of it as a technology company that could make these supercomputers to, we're an animation company. In 2004, when Jobs had to go back and renegotiate with Disney, he and Michael Eisner just did not get along. And so he cut off contract negotiations with Disney. And then in 2006, Bob Iger came in and said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to buy Pixar for $7.4 billion. In fact, $4.4 billion of his wealth, of Steve Jobs' wealth, comes from that transaction. He became the largest Disney shareholder, and his estate, at least, remains so today. What I think is interesting about the last week and all this news about Steve Jobs is I admire Steve Jobs, and I don't, want to take anything away from his achievements. They are phenomenal. I mean, let's face it, everybody's wondering what's going to happen to Apple, because there is no new Steve Jobs at Apple, because Steve Jobs wouldn't work for Steve Jobs if he had to. So that by default means there's nobody there that can replace him. But at the same time, he wasn't exactly a saint. And, I wonder if this new book that's being written by Walter Isaacson, who unfortunately could not join us because he's, he said he was busy rewriting certain aspects of the book when we reached him. It's kind of, I'm hoping that it's not hagiographic, I think is the word, that it's not going to be hagiography.
Right. It's not going to, I'm sure it won't. It'll be a warts and all biography, I'm certain. It's authorized, but I'm sure he will, not have done it unless he could do it well.
Right. But here's why I hope that, because I went back and in November of 1996, I believe it was, at this point, you had Toy Story about to be released on home video. Now, by home video, I mean VHS, okay? It's November of 1996. And Jobs is really upset that Disney's taking all this credit for doing Toy Story, when in reality, when the budget escalated in 1994 to $27 million, they made Pixar take out a $3 million line of credit with Steve Jobs as the personal guarantor. So, it really was a Pixar production from start to finish. I guess what I'm saying is history can be rewritten. In fact, it can be rewritten by the very people who took part in it. And with that, I'd like to play this clip from the Charlie Rose Show. He went on this little road show, Steve Jobs, with John Lasseter to talk about how important Pixar was to Toy Story. And this is what Steve Jobs had to say about the 10 years leading up to the release of Toy Story. Now, we know what the truth is now, that it was very bumpy, very unprofitable, and was not meant to be an animation company. Here's what Steve Jobs had to say.
How do you think of yourself? After Apple, after Next, how do you think of yourself?
The things that I've done in my life, I think the things we do now at Pixar, these are team sports. They're not something that one person does. You have to have an extraordinary team, because these are you're trying to climb a mountain with a whole party of people, a lot of stuff to bring up the mountain. So one person can't do it. And I first got involved in this when I heard about this incredible group of computer graphics specialists that George Lucas had assembled at Lucasfilm that he wanted to sell. And so I went up there and saw what they were doing, and I met the leader of this group, Dr. Ed Catmull. And Ed told me about his dream, which was to make the first computer animated feature film someday, and showed me what this team was working on. And I was blown away. I spent a lot of time in computer graphics with the Macintosh and the LaserWriter and stuff, but this was way beyond anything I'd seen. And so I bought into that dream, both spiritually, if you will, and financially, and we bought the computer division from George and incorporated it as Pixar. John was there from the very start. Ed was there, and we were joined by other people along the way. And it took us 10 years to do it. But
what was so hard?
Oh, there were...
Good question, huh, John?
You know...
Yeah, that's a good question.
It took us a long time to build the technical foundation to do this stuff. We were pioneering every step of the way. Pixar invented all this stuff. But as John says, we don't view ourselves as a technology company. Our product is content. We're an entertainment company. And all this technology really is just in the service of the storytelling,
the
service of the creative people. And computer animation is even a little bit of a misnomer. The computers don't do the animation. They do the drawing. And they crank on these drawings for, like, you know, 3 hours by one of the fastest computers in the world, which is why the drawings are three-dimensional. But the animators act. You know, I've watched John and his team work, and they are the heart and soul of the characters. They do all the acting, not the computers.
Okay, but I'm going to just make sure I understand.
I found that fascinating upon hearing that after rereading all of this history.
Yeah, well, everybody, you know, retroactively wants to, you know, or reimagines the smartness and the insight right from the beginning, even though he wasn't focused on animation. I think that's sort of natural.
No, but he did see something. I think, the benefit of a Steve Jobs is he saw something in there, and he was very patient and kept plowing money in, whether it was for selfish reasons or not. You know, he spent $50 million of his own money when he was only worth $185 million, and he was also spending money on Next Computer, and he kept with it for 10 years. So he knew that at the end, there was something there. He just really wasn't sure what it was, and he kind of was focusing on the wrong thing up front, which was we can sell these massive supercomputers for $29,000 to $50,000 a piece when nobody wanted them.
Well, that's a smart, I mean, you've always said we're working on a business ourselves right now about books. And you've said repeatedly to keep in mind that you think you know what your business is, but you have to remain open to the idea that when you build a website or you build a business and suddenly you see people using it in a way you didn't expect, that you have to be ready to switch and say, okay, wait a second, maybe this is our business. We thought it was that, but it might be this thing over here.
Right. That pivot where you, and that's it, the companies that do not pivot are the ones that usually fail. Because they try and say, no, we're supposed to be X, not Y. Well, you know, Steve Jobs was very good at seeing, you know what? I'm emotionally connected to this film. This is the product. This is the shiny object. And he turned the whole company into an animation company. And, you know, when he talks about, you know, John Lasseter was there from the beginning, you know, in a back room in the basement and nobody ever talked to him. But, you know, but now I'm going to make it seem like we were best buds. And, you know, if you should try and look that up online, that Charlie Rose, because John Lasseter is looking at him like, who are you? You know, so, I mean, I think, you know, I that's what interests me about, you know, Steve Jobs and this story, because not only do the public and have connections to their computers and their iPads and their iPhones and their iPods, and the products that Apple creates because of the experience they have with them. But think about the stories that were put forth by Pixar over the following 15 years. You have Finding Nemo, Up, Wall-E, A Bug's Life. All of these stories are now in the culture. And he was a part of that in some way, shape, or form.
Right. He wasn't involved in a creative level like Jeffrey Katzenberg or Walt Disney was in the old days. But he made it happen.
No, and you know, speaking of Disney, a lot of people have started to compare Jobs and Disney because Disney kind of died early in his 60s. He died of cancer as well. And
that left the company adrift creatively for quite a few years. It wasn't until the animation resurgence in the 80s with Michael Eisner and all of them, and Little Mermaid, and, you know, live action movies like Down and Out in Beverly Hills, that they finally regained their footing.
Right, and that was in 1984. So
yeah,
think
that
about
was 20 years or so after he died, right?
Right, and to this day, there's a whole, like, there was a point where people within the company could not make a decision because they, you know, Walt would always make the decisions. Well, Walt wasn't there anymore, so the whole what would Walt do thing, nobody made any decision because that's what was safest. Well, that just completely made the company, you know, spiral out of control, and they were near bankruptcy, frankly.
And people wonder if that will happen to Apple, and they say, oh, look at the launch of this new phone, the iPhone 4S. It wasn't a great launch. People were a little disappointed. I think the stock went down a little bit, but you know what? They're sold out completely on their pre-orders.
That's
every
right.
single phone that they have made is sold out.
Right.
Every single one is taken. So I think they're going to be okay, at least for a while.
Speaking of selling out, that biography by Walter Isaacson, you know, it leapt to the top of Amazon's charts. Now Sony is buying the film rights to the biography.
Which makes me say, you mean they weren't sold already?
Yeah, I know. I was a little surprised at that too.
Because it's very hard for books to come out now with not having their film rights already bought by somebody somewhere. So especially something like that. It's a pretty visible property.
You know, we could talk about his whole ad, you know, all the ad campaigns, including the Think Different campaign, which is absolutely phenomenal. But, you know, we probably should move on since that's been covered. You want to talk about it? Why don't we talk a little bit about television, really just run past it? Because does anybody care about the Playboy Club, Free Agents, Hater, How to Be a Gentleman? They've all been canceled.
Well, How to Be a Gentleman has been canceled. I mean, I know they moved it to Saturday nights. Is it canceled as well?
They stopped production on it, which is another way of saying.
Oh, they did. I didn't know
that.
Yeah. Right. As always, new shows, you know, most new shows fail. There have been full season pickups for Up All Night and Whitney from NBC. Two Broke Girls on CBS, and New Girl, the Zooey Deschanel show on Fox. What's interesting is that those are all sitcoms. And
that's
it's been
right.
a long time since sitcoms have been hot. So they're all coming back. And one show that is coming back is The Simpsons. There was a big back and forth. You know, when a show has been on the air for a really long time, it gets more and more expensive to make. And The Simpsons has been declining and declining in ratings. It's now not the big animated show on Fox. That would be Family Guy. And so Fox was saying, look, it's costing us $5 million an episode to make this show. It's too much money for the, you know, we've already got enough episodes in syndication. We don't really need any more. You know, we want to keep the show on the air, but it's too expensive. And they'd just gotten a raise in 2008 up to like $440,000 per episode for the eight main people who do the voices on the show, like Harry Shearer and Nancy Cartwright.
That's right.
And now Fox has come back and slapped them back down again. And they've all taken a big pay cut to keep the show going and keep their payday still happening.
Yeah, I mean, Harry Shearer, who plays several voices on The Simpsons, said, look, I'll take a 70% pay cut. Just give me some of the back end. And they were like, no, we don't think
so. Ha, ha, ha. Right. They've already got enough back end and enough episodes to last them forever in syndication. So they don't really need more episodes. So they really had the cast over a barrel. Animated voiceover people are always, you know, last in line. People used to make Disney animated films. Like big stars would do it because they'd be happy. Oh, they have a movie they could take their kids to and say, look, I'm in a Disney animated film. They do it for peanuts. And then they'd say, my God, this movie's making $500 million. Maybe I should have gotten a bigger salary. When you're talking television and voiceover people, they just never get money. They're never going to get back end. If they were, it should have happened, you know, 10 to 15 years ago. So at this stage of the show, they just really don't have much leverage.
That's right. 1989, when the show first started, they were getting $30,000 per episode. That's what people whose faces were seen on episodes would get. So that was already rich at that time.
Well, that's not a lot of money.
For doing voice work on an unknown animated series?
Yeah, it's not peanuts, but I wouldn't say that was top dollar for sitcom stars at the time.
Right. I mean, we don't know what they wound up getting this time, but it's probably around $250,000, $260,000 per episode. That's a lot of money.
Right, it is. But as they say, it's a, you know, multi-billion dollar franchise. You know, at some point, the cast of Friends and the cast of The Cosby Show and the cast of other shows are able to step forward and say, hey, we want a bigger piece of the back end pie because you're going to make a gazillion dollars on this show. And they never got that. They did increase their salary for 3 years.
That's
and
right.
Now they're being pushed back down again. So that leverage they gained in 2008 has not lasted because the show has dropped a lot in the ratings.
Right. And there was some talk about that it would be worth more being canceled because Fox would get out of all of their current syndication contracts and could actually rewrite their contracts.
Right. There's a caveat in the contract that Fox signed when they launched the show that they can't sell it to basic cable.
Right.
And so if they ended the show, they would be able to free themselves up from that caveat once the show is off the air, and they'd be able to reap $500, $750 million in selling the show to basic cable channels like Comedy Central or FX or whoever it might be.
That's right, which kind of made the whole thing a big deal.
Yes, or a big whoop.
Yes, and in fact, we should move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Remember that Netflix plan to split its DVD and streaming video into two different companies, one called Quickster and one called Netflix, and then force customers to create two different accounts and sign-ins and all of that mumbo-jumbo? Well, never mind about that. In a lightning-fast turnaround, Netflix said it was dumping the plan. The price changes remain in place, but forget about that need for two accounts and two names and two queues and all that. It's all Netflix and it's all good. They hope. There's a difference between moving quickly, which Netflix has done very well for years, and moving too fast, which is what we did in this case, said Netflix CEO Reed Hastings. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. You know, they're in crisis mode. They acted quickly, then they acted quickly again. Now they've acted quickly again to try and stop the bleeding. It seems to be that, you know, if you think you've made a mistake, the sooner you admit it and move on, the better. So it's a good move.
Want your fix of Justice League? Don't go to Barnes & Noble. Amazon announced an exclusive deal with DC Comics that gave it sole access to certain graphic novels and digital versions of their comic books. Barnes & Noble has long insisted that any publisher that limits their titles to only one outlet is harming customers and the business in general, not to mention their Nook e-reader, and they won't stand for it. So in response to this deal, Barnes & Noble is pulling DC graphic novels from its store shelves. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I think I hate those exclusive deals where you have to figure out who handles a product. It is very bad news for customers. They shouldn't have to wonder whether, you know, it's Amazon or somebody else. You know, you want to buy your DC comic book, you shouldn't have to only go to Kindle. It's a bad idea. I hate them. And I think Barnes & Noble is right to stand up and do everything they can to fight it now, early stages, so that it doesn't spread as a practice.
The BBC is slimming down. That's a good thing. I thought they were a little overweight myself. The UK broadcaster was embarrassed by the massive salaries of mid-level bureaucrats and a few other scandals, so it was forced to take a spending freeze through 2017, and that's meant a need to cut £1 billion over the next 5 years, which is like $1 trillion, by the way. It announced it was cutting some 2,000 jobs, moving some people around, pushing BBC Two to air only reruns during the day, and refocusing on its flagship channel, BBC One. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. BBC is a huge provider of news and quality programming all over the world, not just in the UK. So it's always unnerving when they get a big cut in their salary. But they probably had some fat, but it sounds like they didn't trim the fat. They just trimmed the things that we like most about them.
Oh, good point. Online streaming music company Ardio, R-D-I-O, just got free, really free, you know, get a chunk of music to listen to free every month, and you don't have to listen to any ads. They hope this will make them the place for fans to start, and if they get hooked, hopefully pony up the $5 a month for unlimited web streaming or $10 a month for unlimited web and mobile streaming. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's a nice another iteration in what's available to people when they want to sample audio streaming. It's a smart move. Differentiate yourself from the competitors.
Well, the competitors, they're actually kind of doing exactly what the competitors are doing. Spotify and Moog are both doing this.
Are there no ads on Spotify?
Well, okay. Actually, there are ads on Spotify, and I'm sure there will be ads on Moog. So you're right. That does.
Hence the differentiation.
Yes. Who directed the upcoming movie Dredd? A reboot of the Sylvester Stallone action film Judge Dredd, itself based on a comic book. You would think it was the actual director, Pete Travis, but he's been locked out of the editing room while the producers and screenwriter Alex Garland work on shaping the material. In fact, Garland has been so involved in shaping the film that they're considering applying to have him named co-director, even though he wasn't involved in shooting a single scene and has never directed a movie before. Good luck with that. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop unless they succeed. That's an absolutely bizarre idea that he could be named co-director when he was never on the set.
Yeah, I'm sure the DJ would love that.
Yeah.
A horse is a horse, of course, of course, unless it's the famous Mr. Ed. If you're over 50, you know that's the theme song of the Mr. Ed. Oh, you wanted me to sing that, didn't you?
No, that's all
okay. You know that that's the theme song of the Mr. Ed TV show. Soon people under 20 will know that as well, because the not-so-classic TV sitcom is being turned into a feature film. Bad idea. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Yeah, I mean, it'll probably do quite well, but, you know.
You never know, but good yeah. Lord.
I mean, if Dr. Doolittle can do well by being rebooted, what do you know? In what feels like the beginning of the end, Spin Magazine, once a rival to Rolling Stone, is switching from 11 issues a year to just 6, and plans to focus more and more on the web, which is another way of saying the print magazine business isn't working out too well for them. Big deal or big what, Michael?
It's a big deal. It feels like a sad day. Print magazines everywhere are struggling. You know, when you say we're going to cut back your issues and focus on the web, it's really not good news, especially for music fans. It's never been a magazine I really held to my heart much. It always seemed a little too cool for me.
Did you hold it to your head or maybe your foot? Or
exactly. No. But I'm sad to see them be in trouble.
Lars von Trier is shutting up forever. Film director Lars von Trier released a statement this week. It read, "Today at 2 p.m., I was questioned by the police of North Zealand in connection with charges made by the prosecution of Grasse in France from August 2011 regarding a possible violation of prohibition in French law against justification of war crimes. The investigation covers comments made during the press conference in Cannes in May 2011. And if you have not heard us talk about this before, then this is the first episode of Showbiz Sandbox you're listening to. Due to these serious accusations, I have realized that I do not possess the skills to express myself unequivocally, and I have therefore decided from this day forth to refrain from all public statements and interviews." End quote. What do you think, Michael? Big deal, big whoop.
It's a big deal. I'm always uncomfortable with these laws in countries about, you know, you can't deny the Holocaust or you can't do this or that. It always makes me uneasy as far as, you know, people should be free to be morons and idiots. We've long covered Lars von Trier. He was not in any way, shape, or form justifying war crimes. And it's absurd to say that he was. It's absurd that he should face legal proceedings over what happened at the press conference. It's just all a ridiculous megillah. But if it keeps him shutting up and just making movies, maybe it'll be the best for him.
A woman in Michigan didn't enjoy the movie Drive starring Ryan Gosling, and so she's suing. That's what all Americans do. Not because the movie was bad or anything like that. She's suing because the movie trailer was misleading and led her to expect an action film when, in fact, Drive is essentially a quiet character study. The woman hopes it can become a class action lawsuit and will end the practice of misleading trailers. Yeah, again, good luck with that. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal because it opens up a lot of possibilities. We can sue the trailers for comedies when they show all the good jokes in the trailer and then you get to the film and everything else is stupid. You could sue over trailers that reveal the ending of the movie or 90% of the plot. I mean, there's just a lot of great possibilities that open up here.
Will your cable set-top box become a thing of the past? Microsoft hopes so. Its Xbox system has been an alternate set-top box for users of or subscribers to AT&T UVerse. That means no monthly fee for cable set-top box users and, yes, less income for AT&T UVerse. That's why people thought the idea wouldn't spread. But now Verizon is letting customers use the Xbox as their de facto cable set-top box as well, and even Comcast is allowing video on demand to be accessed through it. Some think Xbox's search function, which allows you to find, say, new episodes of a new show airing on prime time, plus reruns on Hulu and video on demand of past seasons as well, they say it's the killer app. Others think content providers are realizing they need to be anywhere and everywhere their customers want to watch content. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's kind of a big deal. People have been trying for years to be the person that provides that set-top box to be the portal for everybody's home thing, and this looks like the biggest step forward so far, and Microsoft did it.
One of the benefits of online video streaming site Hulu has always been the idea of choice. They've always touted choice. Not only are there thousands of television episodes to select from, but you get to choose when and where you want to watch them. Because Hulu doesn't think you have enough choices in your life, they are going one step further by launching their AdSwap product. The technology gives its users even more control in deciding which ads they want to see. Don't like a commercial you're watching? No problem, just choose another one. It makes the whole concept of skipping commercials to a whole new level. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop.
Okay.
I get to say I want to see another ad and waste. Instead, I've watched 5 seconds of one ad and then jump to a new one and watch 30 seconds of that. And then, you know, good Lord. How about if I can jump the ad altogether? Then I'm happy. That's what my DVR is for.
I was just going to say, well, welcome to TiVo.
Yes.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. We're going to move right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Certainly this first piece won't affect you. Disney, Robert Iger, their chairman, their CEO, he will become their chairman at some point. He signed on for another 5 years, and they've set a succession plan. So he is 60 years old. Disney signed another 5-year contract with him, and he will be there through, I think, what, 2015?
As CEO through 2015, and then he ends his chairmanship in June of 2016. So basically, he's saying, I'm going to retire in 5 years. We're going to get a successor and groom somebody, et cetera.
Right. So there's no Michael Eisner issue like there was, you know, with when.
Well, they haven't named the successor yet, so there could be.
Yeah, good point. Who knows? In 5 years, they might say, oh, please stay around, Mr. Iger.
Yeah, exactly.
The other story we're going to talk about this week has to do with premium video on demand. Speaking of video on your Xbox, it turns out that Universal Pictures is going to be doing a test of premium VOD in Portland and Atlanta, and they are going to release Tower Heist not 90 days or 60 days after its theatrical release, but 3 weeks after it debuts in theaters.
That's the comedy starring Ben Stiller and Eddie Murphy. It's sort of like a more comedic version of Ocean's 11 is the idea I get.
Yeah, I kind of got that idea as well.
And so we were talking about video on demand and what premium video on demand might be. They're going to be charging $60 if you want to watch this movie in your home 3 weeks after it debuts in the theaters. And you'll be able to do this if you live in Portland or Atlanta. And they're going to see how many people try out the service and what they do with it and how they like it and that sort of thing. But where's the irony?
The irony is in that Brett Ratner, who was the director of said movie, Tower Heist, kind of came out earlier this spring when Four Studios said they were going to release movies early for premium video on demand and charge $30, and they were going to release 6 weeks after they had premiered. He came out and said, no way, I don't like this whole idea, and you know, I don't like this whole 60 days, you know, pay $30 thing. Well, guess what? He was told, we're doing that with your film. In fact, we're doing it 3 weeks after.
Yes, it sort of seems like an FU to him, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, that is in no way, shape, or form why that's being done. The reason this is being done is, who owns Universal again?
Comcast?
That's right. Interesting that Universal Pictures should be the very first studio to try and really be aggressive and push and shrink that theatrical window. I wonder why that is.
Who the heck would pay $60 to watch that movie at home?
I don't know. Andrew Wallenstein over at Variety said, you know, they maybe should charge 60 cents after he saw the trailer.
Oh, nice. But I mean, that you would need seven to eight people in Atlanta or Portland in order to break even.
That's right.
It just seems crazy to me. And it's not a family movie, so you're not going to watch it with your kids.
Right. But they're doing it over, you know, it hits right before the Thanksgiving holiday. You know, it's released November 4th. 3 weeks later, it's Thanksgiving weekend. Everybody's...
That's a good point.
Yeah, so that's exactly why they're doing it around that one, and that's why they're testing it. The previous mentioned premium VOD tests were kind of failures, but people inside the industry say, well, that was because you were trying to do it with Sucker Punch and Paul and Just Go With It, movies that nobody wanted to see anyway.
Right, this may not be a good movie, but it's certainly a commercial prospect.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of move is precisely what I feared when Comcast was allowed to buy Universal.
Well, it's just an experiment in the business. You think it's just a disastrous idea in general? I mean, I don't think it's a very promising idea, but there might be a very small limited market for it. But I don't really like it in general, but there's no reason not to test it and see what it's like and see if people go crazy and love it. You know, a revenue stream is a revenue stream. You just got to be very careful before you mess with the business plan that makes you billions of dollars.
Right. And that's what I wrote on Celluloid Junkie in kind of concluding. I said, you know what? Sometimes I watch my children make mistakes, and I purposefully don't get involved because I know that if they make the mistakes themselves, they're unlikely to repeat it. So my feeling is, you know what, exhibitors? Let them go ahead. Let Universal go ahead and do this.
And 10 people will buy it.
Right. We'll see where they are at the end on the other side of it. Well, we should probably wrap up Inside Baseball and move right along into listener email. We have a very long email that I'm going to surmise.
Surmise?
Surmise. You know what? Just for you, Michael, I'm going to summarize it.
Okay.
I mean, it's from CJ Flynn of dcinematools.com, and he is writing in, apparently we hit a little bit of a hot button issue with this whole 3D glasses thing when we talked about that last week. So he writes in and he says, nice show, guys. I want to make a point or two about the 3D glasses issue. Generally, your exposition was perfect, but it was impossible for you to come to a satisfying or even logical conclusion because you left out a main ingredient. No one buys the Real D system. No one ends up owning it after so many payments are made. As Sperling pointed out, in fact, none of the 3D equipment is made part of the virtual print fee agreements. Neither are any of the new digital audio processors that most exhibitors need to buy, or the professional-grade satellite equipment or cable boxes, etc. And so he goes on to talk about the difference between Real-D and Expand-D, and how the studios are subsidizing glasses really only for Real-D, because everybody else, Dolby, Expand, you have to buy their glasses. The exhibitors have to buy them outright. They have to buy the systems outright, whereas you never buy a Real-D system.
But the Real-D is the dominant one in the market right now.
I think
it's
like 90%.
Right. And why are the studios working with them so close hand in hand?
I'm not sure. I mean, because originally the licensing deal for the technology was advantageous, but it certainly isn't so right now.
Doesn't CJ Flynn point out that they have points on Real-D on the company, that they have stock options and stuff like that?
Oh, yes, that's true, actually. He kind of, the reasons are convoluted, he writes, and when you look at Real-D's 10Q and see items like "we record revenue net of motion picture exhibitor stock options," and later describing that motion picture exhibitor stock options in connection with some of our motion picture exhibitor, basically he's saying that they gave options in Real-D to the exhibitors.
So the exhibitors, meaning not the studios, but the theater chains, have some stock options in Real-D.
Right, correct.
So but that was also one of the reasons why they accepted and allowed Real-D to insert themselves into their system and get a piece of the pie?
I think some of the exhibitors have shares. Other exhibitors can't afford, you know, Dolby or Expand or Master Image, you know, which are $30,000 plus just for the 3D equipment, not the digital projector and server. So I think what they're doing is, you know, if you're a mid-grade exhibitor, you need 3D. It's cheap. You go for it.
All right, so to summarize, when a theater chain wants to convert and make their theaters available to show 3D, they have to buy and purchase a lot of things, right?
That's right, yes.
Not just the 3D equipment. You have to upgrade all other areas as well.
That's right.
So they are paying for that, correct?
The studios pay for the projector and the server, period. That's it.
The studios?
The studios, yes.
You mean the exhibitors?
They pay for a portion of the projectors and the servers through a virtual print fee. They pay about 70% of it, 75% of it. The exhibitors pick up the other part.
Okay. So exhibitors pay 30% of that equipment. The Real-D equipment comes in free, but they get a piece of the ticket price.
That's right. Real-D gets, you know, has their hand in the box office.
And how does this affect the fact of what's all going on with charging the cost of glasses and increasing the price and making the exhibitors pay rather than the studios?
Well, the exhibitor generally marks up, this is CJ talking now, they mark up the movie so they don't have to absorb a very direct hit, a check sent to Real-D.
They charge us more. So right. If Real-D gets $2, they just increase the ticket price by $2.
Right. And when the ticket price goes up, the studios take increases because of their percentage. So Real-D's price kind of gets doubled.
What do you mean?
Well, because Real-D is taking a percentage. So if you increase the amount you're charging for a ticket, Real-D's percentage will just increase as well.
They get a percentage of the ticket price, not a flat fee?
That is correct. Well, I think it depends on the deal, but yeah.
So the $3 covers both the money going to Real-3D and the extra money that goes to the studio because the ticket price is higher.
That's right.
Okay. And so what does this mean long term? What does this reveal to us?
I think it means that there's going to be a continuing fight over these glasses.
But knowing that the exhibitors don't pay for the equipment means they're more likely or less likely, or what where's their attitude?
Well, I think at this point, Real-D has kind of insinuated itself into the industry. But as technology refreshes, we'll see if they remain the dominant player because of this issue.
Well, and he's got a much longer email, and we'll post that in our show notes. He talks about picture quality and some other issues, which are all very interesting. And you can read the entire email online on our website.
In fact, yes, it's in the comments section of last week's episode, episode 121. You can leave comments on our website to any of the episodes. In fact, you can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also subscribe to the podcast, not only through iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or in your RSS reader, but also on Stitcher. So go to Stitcher.com and find out all about it. You can find all of that information or CJ's email or links to any of the episodes we've discussed on today's episode in our show notes on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz, all of his work can be found at michaelgiltz.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.